How were the good, well-meaning people of Canada convinced to aid and abet the detention of thousands of Eastern Europeans, genocidal policies towards Indigenous people, and the carrying out of imperialist violence in Africa, Haiti, and elsewhere? Could J.S. Woodsworth and other left icons have been defenders of empire? What role did the social gospel and elite institutions like Wesley College have in subverting the historic Winnipeg General Strike? Are manipulative narratives of Canadian exceptionalism repeating themselves today? On this week's Global Research News Hour, we discuss the mythologies that persist in Canada historically and that continue to hold its residents captive and willing agents of oppression in service of the country's elites. We spend the hour speaking with longtime anti-war activist Richard Saunders on the occasion of the release of the latest issue of Press for Conversion. On this week's program, Canada Syndrome, Good People Supporting Mass Internment, War and Genocide, a conversation with Richard Saunders. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of May 13th, 2016. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabe territory on the homeland of the Métis Nation. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. The CIA institutionalized the term conspiracy theory in its very successful attempt to derail the honest attempts to investigate the roles of various governmental agencies and individuals that were involved in the execution of President Kennedy in 1963. Of course, all clandestine state-sponsored secret service agencies like the CIA, MI6, and Mossad routinely and shamelessly make use of lies, secrecy, deception, and false flag operations in their daily affairs. It is a fact of life for such secret agencies, and it is all accomplished in the name of quote-unquote national security. Secret intelligence agencies such as the CIA routinely concoct conspiracies that involve spying, regime changes, destabilization of governments, expansion of military bases, and even torture, disappearances, suicides, quote-unquote, and extrajudicial assassinations as a matter of course. Of course, all leaked evidence of what are often unethical, immoral, or even criminal deeds must be denied. That comes from the article, Weaponizing the Term Conspiracy Theory, Disinformation Agents and the CIA, by Dr. Gary G. Coles, posted May 11th. If the EU were to collapse today, both the TTIP and the TISA talks would come to a standstill. Any one of the 28 EU countries, or better even, of the 19 Eurozone countries, could bring the EU down. A Brexit, a fiasco emerging from the forthcoming rehash of the Spanish elections, or a firm decision by a government to default on its mostly troika-imposed debt could bring the house of cards of the dollar pyramid scheme to fall and erase once and for all the enslaving dollar-euro hegemony. Imagine what a collapse of the EU and the Eurozone would mean for the Greek people, though rumors have it that more than half the Greek are still adamant in hanging on to the destructive euro. I bet its collapse would have hundreds of thousands dancing in the streets. That comes from the article, The Collapse of the European Union, Return to National Sovereignty and to Happy Europeans, by Peter Koenig, posted May 11th. For years now, we have admired Roger Waters' moral courage, his refusal to back down from his criticism of Israel, even if his career is torched by his witness. and I have heard rumors of that career blackmail being levied at the legendary musician who never met his father or grandfather because they died freeing Europe, and who burst into rock and roll fame without even wanting that when he was in his early 20s because he was political before he was musical. Those rumors are confirmed. Now, this committed soul has burst out in the English press with a description of the vicious smears the Israel lobby has used against him, which he has overcome in an effort to gather others to join him in speaking out against Israeli apartheid. Pointing out that British musicians have supported BDS, Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions campaign, Waters says that American artists are scared shitless against such actions because their careers, quote, will be destroyed, unquote. But we need them desperately, as we did in Vietnam days. That comes from the article, American musicians are scared their careers will be destroyed if they speak up for Palestinians, says Roger Waters, by Philip Weiss, posted May 11th, originally appearing at Mondo Weiss. On Tuesday, in an open military provocation, the Obama administration authorized the U.S. Navy to send a guided missile destroyer into the 12 nautical mile territorial zone surrounding Chinese-held Fiery Cross Reef, located in the Spratly Island chain in the South China Sea. The operation was carried out on the fraudulent pretext of, quote-unquote, freedom of navigation. That is, the assertion by U.S. imperialism that it has the right to send its military forces anywhere it chooses at any time in Chinese-claimed waters. The U.S. Navy carried out a freedom of navigation mission that last October in Chinese-claimed waters around Subi Reef in the South China Sea and a second operation in January near Triton Island in the Paracel Island chain. On those occasions, China did not react militarily but issued strongly worded diplomatic protests. The response to the intrusion near Fiery Cross Reef indicates that from this point on, U.S. provocations will be engaged by Chinese forces, posing the danger of a military clash. That comes from the article, War Danger Grows Following New U.S. Provocation in South China Sea, by James Cogan, posted May 11th, originally appearing at World Socialist website. In 2014, the Sino-Iranian trade volume totaled $52 billion U.S., compared to a Russian-Iranian trade volume of only $1.6 billion U.S., and $10 billion between Iran and the entire EU-28. During nuclear sanctions, China was Iran's most significant foreign trade partner, exporting capital goods and engineering services and investing in infrastructure projects. With nuclear sanctions now lifted, China seems to be aware that whatever the obstacles for European firms, it might face increased competition. Losing no time, the Chinese president, Xi Jinping, paid a visit to Iran in January, signing a Sino-Iranian Comprehensive Strategic Partnership and announcing 17 agreements in the energy, trade, and industrial sectors. Iran is important to China's One Belt, One Road initiative that would join markets from China to Central Asia and the Middle East. That comes from the article, Iran, Europe Eyes a New Silk Road and Squares Up to Russia and China, by Moritz Piper, posted May 11th, originally appearing at NSNBC. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. A number of myths pervade the history of social reform in Canada. Canadians of all ideologies typically embrace the commonly held narrative of Canada as the peaceable kingdom, or Canada as the nation of peacekeepers and such. The reality, however, is far less than benign.
Moreover, these narratives have served to help mobilize support for state violence directed both internally and abroad, or so argues our next guest. His name is Richard Saunders. He is the organizer with the Coalition Opposed to the Arms Trade and the lead writer, researcher, and editor of the long-running magazine Press for Conversion. The latest issue is called Captive Canada, Renditions of the Peaceable Kingdom at War from Narratives of World War I and the Red Scare to the Mass Internment of Civilians. Welcome, Richard Saunders.
Yeah, thanks very much.
So, Richard Saunders, may I ask, it's been a while since you've put out a copy of Press for Conversion. I mean, how long have you been researching this particular issue of the magazine and this subject you call Canada Syndrome?
Well, the last few years, but it's sort of been a culmination of my work in the peace movement I've been actively busying myself in the peace movement for about 30 years. So it's sort of a culmination of all those years of research but in particular, the stuff about World War I and the concentration camps and the forced labor camps and that's dealt with in this particular issue, I guess the last year or so has been the main focus of my efforts.
I was wondering if there's a specific example of something that just stood out about the way the anti-war movement, such as it is, or the peace movement is conducting itself that may have led you to go down this sort of psychological path.
Well, I guess I've been thinking along these lines pretty much since I first got involved in the 1980s. At that time, I was involved in organizing nonviolent direct actions, like civil disobedience, through an organization that doesn't exist anymore. It's the Alliance for Nonviolent Action. And we organized big sit-down protests. And there was talk in those days about kind of a rift within the movement between those who would be more radical in terms of not just their actions of being willing to risk arrest and sit down and block the gates of a weapons bazaar, for example, something we did in 1989 when I was involved in when I started COAT, Coalition Opposed to the Arms Trade. So over the years, I've had the, I guess, freedom to research and study and try to understand things that I felt that the mainstream peace movement wasn't looking at. So I've always tried to, okay, well, what is the mainstream peace movement missing here? What are they leaving out of the narrative? So, for example, in 2004, when Canada, the U.S., and France invaded and occupied Haiti and overthrew the government there, and other Canadians, more radical peace activists, human rights activist types, we focused on how Canadian mainstream peace, human rights, and development organizations were supporting that coup and the dictatorship that was installed in Haiti, and how they were funded by CETA. And so again, it's this split between more radical activists who are working on peace, development, human rights issues, and the more mainstream, and often those non-governmental organizations are funded by the government, but they're not always funded by the government. And so what is it? Why is it that these organizations support something that to the radicals like myself seems so obvious? This is, you know, we're supporting the U.S. military. It's not just that they're funded by the government, because not all of them are. Some of these groups aren't funded by the government. So what is it? Well, it has to do with narratives, and this is something that's become much, much more clear to me over the last year. Good, honest, decent, well-meaning people in these different progressive movements can become captivated by these narratives, which lead them to believe that what they're doing is actually a good thing, but really they're doing more harm than good, because they're going along with a government-sponsored program. It could be genocide, like with the residential schools,
The way you put it in the magazine, you do invoke a quote from Samuel Taylor Coleridge of the willing suspension of disbelief.
Right.
As a tool for instilling faith and embracing an imaginary world. And then you posit the question, what happens when you suspend disbelief on a long-term basis in a state narrative?
Right.
And so I suppose that's what we're seeing right now. And this is something that just – you're not just talking about war, but going back – over a century with the whole business of the occupy, like how was it we were able to support basically genocidal policies against the indigenous peoples, as well as the mass internments and so on and so forth.
Right. Yeah. As a kid in high school, I was inspired by Coleridge and his romantic poetry, and it was 200 years ago, this year, 1817, that he came up with this expression that everybody knows now, willing suspension of disbelief. So he used it to talk about how people set aside their disbelief in an obvious falsehood so that they can enjoy some cultural or artistic expression like poetry or we could think of it or watching a movie, although they didn't have movies then, but nowadays but often people think of it with a movie. Well, it was a science fiction movie and there were aliens and whatever, but I set that aside and I didn't question that. I just wanted to enjoy the movie, and so that meant that I had to willingly suspend my disbelief in all these false things that were going on in the movie, like aliens or whatever. Well, the same thing happens when people go along with and they suspend their disbelief in a general cultural narrative. For example, Aboriginals are inferior, blacks are inferior, Christians are inferior, non-Christians. So there's this feeling of superiority or whatever, which, part of you might think, well, I don't know about that. Is that true? Are we really superior or not? But you're willing to suspend it and go along with the official narrative. So I think that a lot of the people who were the most involved in these crimes, in genocidal crimes, like the residential schools, like forcing people to be on reservations, and so that they couldn't live their culture, their religion, their trade, etc. So it's another way of destroying an enemy culture. So people who believe those official narratives about others, the xenophobic, racist, ethnocentric narratives, they actually, I think most of them who were administering and running these programs, actually really believed it. So they're not. And they are the best people to spread these false narratives. The best people to spread a false narrative are not kind of lying, right-wing, corporate elite, some little clique of, really nasty types who are trying to deceive us. It's not them, because you can see through their what they're saying more easily, because if they're lying, it's easier to see they're lying. But if somebody actually believes what they're saying, then it's harder to perceive that it's a lie or that it isn't a lie, really, because they really believe it. Mm. So
this idea then, all of these narratives do serve a function of allowing for a certain Eurocentric domination of the land at the expense
right.
of indigenous peoples and
land
a certain
plunder.
And but also to block the influence of the newcomers from Eastern Europe with different political ideologies. And so this is all it seems so convenient in a sense that people if you're correct, people actually believe these things, and it just happens to play into this,
it's not a coincidence that it plays into the imperial agenda, for power and control over wealth and resources. It's not a coincidence. I believe there are people who know that the narratives are a lie. I'm not saying that there aren't people that know that it's a lie. I'm just saying that so often, well, first thing, it's really hard to know who really realizes a lie and who has just been suckered in by it and really believes it. I think the majority of people that are going along with and accepting, sort of standing by, folded arms and watching these horrible things in the world happening, as well as most of the people who are actually carrying out these programs of genocide, up to and including genocide, actually believe it. But do they? It's very difficult troubling problem, you know, because at some level, do they not realize? Do they not understand that they're complicit in something despicable or something that feeds that corporate agenda? You know,
I wonder if you could just give us a couple of examples. For example, there was the renditions of Eastern Europeans around the time of the war. What was in place that allowed the wider public to just embrace this as not only acceptable but necessary?
Yeah, we've been talking in very general terms, and you really do need to get some specific examples to make sense of these sort of general themes or principles or theories that we've been talking about. Okay, so leading up to the Second World War in Canada, or sorry, not the Second World War, the First World War. So in the early part of the 1900s, probably the most powerful progressive movement at that time was called the Social Gospel, and its leaders were religious. They were largely Methodists. J.S. Woodsworth is still well known to many progressive Canadians, and he was the first leader, and he was very instrumental in founding the CCF, which became the NDP in 1961. So anyway, back in before World War I, the Social Gospel had completely, which was the most progressive wing within the churches. So these are progressive, good, well-meaning people who were trying to help others, trying to uplift others who they saw as less less well-off than themselves, and in many ways they saw them as inferiors. So they were trying to help by doing education, by civilizing, Christianizing, educating those who were from lower classes or inferior races. This is the way that they looked at it, okay? And these were progressive people, like J.S. Woodsworth. They embraced the residential schools. They thought it was a good thing because they were helping these poor savages, these heathens, these uncivilized, unchristian people, and they needed to teach them. They needed to destroy Aboriginal cultures in order to civilize and Christianize and Canadianize. They talked about Canadianizing. Okay, so it wasn't just the Aboriginals that they thought were inferior. J.S. Woodsworth wrote a book in, I think it was 1908 or was it 1909? I can't remember now. I have it in my hand. I won't look up the date on it. But in that, it's called Strangers Within Our Gates, Coming Canadians, and he kind of, each chapter looks at a different ethnic group, and he basically labels every cultural, racial group in the world as inferior to Anglo-Saxons, and he wasn't even happy about all Anglo-Saxons, because he was a classist as well as being a racist and a xenophobe. So he wasn't too crazy about having a lot of very poor white people coming to Canada from England or Germany, although they had the advantage in his mind that they could be enculturated or assimilated to become Canadians, whereas, you know, Asians, people from the Middle East, Africans, Aboriginals, it's really hard to assimilate them, according to the people like J.S. Woodsworth and the Social Gospel at the time. So, but one of the main groups that they really despised were people from Eastern Europe particularly ones who were more radicalized, and they were atheists. So if you've got a socialist, atheist Eastern European who's just fled to Canada to escape there's a huge political turmoil in Russia, in the Russian Empire at the time. In 1905, the Tsarist troops had killed 1,000 or more people in a Bloody Sunday event. It was called Bloody Sunday, and they shot down and killed about 1,000 or more peaceful protesters. And there was a huge, almost successful revolution that happened in 1905 to 1907 in the Russian Empire. I didn't know that much about it, but I learned a lot more about it during my research, and it's fascinating history. So there were huge general strikes and huge protests of hundreds of thousands of people in all these cities all across Eastern Europe, and it didn't succeed, but 10 years later, they did have a successful revolution, and successful in the sense of, getting rid of the Tsar and replacing it with a different system. So it was a revolution that came to fruition, whereas the one in 1905 to 1907, the Tsar remained in power. But a lot of these refugees came to Canada. So the social gospelers, who were very Christian, didn't like them because they were atheists, didn't like them because they were radical revolutionary types, or not all of them were, but some of them were. And the social gospelers and J.S. Woodsworth were most fearful of these Eastern Europeans because they thought they had the greatest potential for becoming radicalized and revolutionary within Canada. So they were quite fearful of a revolution in Canada. In fact, there were fears amongst the imperial elites, European elites, who had colonies all over the world. There was a series of revolts and rebellions and anti-monarchist and anti-imperialist struggles and revolutions that were going on all over the world in all of these different colonies of all of the European powers. So they were really worried, and they were even worried about revolutionaries in Canada. And so I think, and the research that I've done tries to show a different narrative from what we usually hear about when we read about the concentration camps that Eastern Europeans, mostly Ukrainians, were put in Canada. There were about 8,000, mostly Ukrainians, who were put into these forced labor camps, these slave labor camps in Canada. And I think that a big part of the reason why they were targeted was because of the fear that they were going to become radicalized and become revolutionary and cause all sorts of troubles, stir up strikes and things like that in Canada. And so the excuse that was the war, World War One, was used as a pretext or an excuse to round up thousands of these East European immigrants and put them into concentration camps. So it's a different narrative from what exists now as the official narrative. The Canadian government and its allies in the right wing, a nationalist Ukrainian community in Canada, and the Ukrainians in Canada are really split between right and left, even to this day, and they were 100 years ago as well.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. Could you talk about the effect of the social gospel on perpetuating the genocide of Indigenous peoples?
Yeah, sure. So, the social gospel, as I said, was, trying to basically eradicate Aboriginal cultures. And maintain the power of the Christian elites in Canada, the Anglo-Protestant elites, the establishment was, all the major institutions within the state were Christian, and so it just seemed natural to them, to their way of thinking, that Aboriginal people had to be subjugated, they had to be assimilated, and so they put these residential school programs in power, in effect, and the social gospel movement, the role that it played was, in short, to create narratives that the general public, being good, honest people — I think people are generally good, honest, well-meaning, they don't like to do harm, or not. Society isn't made out of psychopaths. People like to think that they're doing the right thing. So the role of these this progressive movement, the social gospel, and its leaders like J.S. Whitworth, was to create narratives that could be used by the general public to get them to not only go along with and sort of stand by and let these horrible cultural genocidal things happen, but to actually take a role in making them happen and contributing their taxes to make them happen and administering the programs.
Well, that's it's interesting, but it still kind of makes you wonder, like, the level of sophistication that would be involved, like a kind of form of a psychological warfare, where xenophobia and good intentions mix in with colonial and imperialist ambitions. And I don't know if you wanted to address if you could talk about masterminds, if you will, who might be directing these things as a kind of military intelligence operation or other.
One person that comes to mind is William Randolph Hearst. Now, he's not a Canadian. This is in the American context, but it's the same thing would apply in Canada with our own equivalents. But maybe people have heard of William Randolph Hearst. He was a corporate tycoon. He was a Democratic congressman in New York. He was the father of so-called yellow journalism. He owned big newspapers, and they had yellow dye in some of their cartoons, and the yellow spread through the paper, and so it was called yellow journalism. So he was the hegemon of a newspaper empire, and of course he fabricated huge webs of deceit and deception to trick people into supporting wars like the Spanish-American War in 1898. So the Hearst family story, of this powerful newspaper magnate, you know, having such a huge impact through the mainstream media on people's attitudes. This is kind of I think what you're talking about. You've got a key individual who has a lot of power in influencing masses of people. So his granddaughter was Patty Hearst. She was kidnapped in 1973 or 74. And she was kidnapped by this radical revolutionary group, which is very spooky group. It was the Symbionese Liberation Army. If people Google it, they can find all sorts of weird stuff about this organization. It had ties to the CIA, and it was a very odd group. At least some of its leaders were linked to the CIA and the FBI. Anyway, that aside, she was kidnapped. And she ended up going along, getting brainwashed, and going along with other bank robberies, kidnappings, I think even a bombing, and all sorts of major crimes. She only spent 2 years in jail. The reason she only spent 2 years in jail, and the reason she was later pardoned by Carter and Clinton, they both sort of exonerated her, what she had done, was because of this thing called the Stockholm Syndrome. There was a bank heist in Sweden in 1973, just before she was kidnapped. And the police psychologist came up with this idea that kidnapped people could be kind of brainwashed into supporting the beliefs and ideologies of their captors. It's an interesting phenomenon that people have probably heard of, the Stockholm Syndrome. So it's interesting, I think, that Patty Hearst was a is seen as a victim of the Stockholm Syndrome, because she went along with her captors and she was brainwashed, and this helped to get her off for doing the crimes that she did. But what about her grandfather? He could capture masses of people. He could kidnap their minds and control their thoughts. Not control, that's a strong word, but I mean he could have a powerful influence over the people that he's sort of holding under his sway through the control of a narrative, through the different narratives that are spread by the newspaper. So, but of course, he never went to jail. He never was, convicted as a criminal for his role in, you could say, metaphorically, kidnapping people, captivating, because captivation is really a central trope here, a central metaphor of what I've been doing of my research, captivation, mass civilian captivation. So people can be captivated and held captive behind bars or behind barbed wire like they were in these concentration camps in World War I and between the wars and during World War II, and like the plans that they had all through the Cold War called the Profunk to round up communists and other radicals in Canada. For 30, 40 years, we had this. The RCMP was planning to round up several thousand people per year. But so you can hold people in behind bars in jail and whatnot, but you can also captivate people's hearts and minds and control their ideologies through the use of narratives. So if you can control people or captivate them, capture them using narratives, it's a much more effective way to control masses of people. Like, it's difficult to put thousands and thousands of people behind barbed wire. They did it in World War I with these forced labor concentration camps. But it's much more effective if you can capture people, control them through narratives.
Yeah, so basically what you're saying is that those of us who accept these narratives on the left, quote-unquote, about responsibility to protect or, trying to civilize the indigenous peoples or, protect us from, dangerous aliens and thereby allowing them to be interned, that all of us in that regard are like Patty Hearst, that we are being subjected to this psychosis that prevents us from seeing the violence that we're doing and brings us closer to the elites who are orchestrating this mess.
Yeah, I mean, what better way, what more powerful way is there in the world to control people than through their culture, through their ideology, through the beliefs that they adopt through being a part of a culture or a nation or an ethnic identity or some kind of systematized ideological structure that holds people's in place. They hold people captive, really. What better way to do it? And the family institution, the institution of the family, is a very powerful one. So for another fascinating thing I thought, it fascinated me anyway, and I think other people might be interested in, is J.S. Woodsworth, his family, his background. Like, where did he get these ideas from? So I looked into his father and his paternal grandfather. I also looked into his mother's ancestors, and they were all imperialists, classists. You know, they were all part of within their society of their times, they were actually playing key roles in subverting or repressing rebellions and radicals. So, for example, his father, who was head of all missionary work in the four western provinces. So his father, James Woodsworth, so that's James Sr., was in charge of all the missionaries for the Methodist Church. And he was, in his autobiography, which was written in 1917, and which his son, J.S. Woodsworth Jr., helped him to edit, in that autobiography, he's very proud of his role in, and the Methodist Church's role in, subverting these heathens and savages and half-breeds, these are terms that he used, who rose up in the Northwest Rebellion, trying to struggle against the land plunder and the reservations that were being a system that was being imposed on them, and the residential schools and the destruction of their culture and their economy and their religion and their ability to move freely around in the landscape. But J.S. Woodsworth's father was very proud of his role in subjugating these radicals who rose up to try to rebel. And his father, going back another generation, so J.S. Woodsworth's grandfather, was involved in opposing the radicals during the Upper Canada Rebellion in York. He was a prominent Methodist, had come from England, sided, he was a British Empire loyalist, sided with the Family Compact, which was this corrupt corporate government elite that basically controlled the legal system and corporations and government. So he was actually given a sword to fight against the rebels, and that sword was passed down generation to generation, and it hung on the wall of J.S. Woodsworth's family home in Winnipeg. Proudly hung on the wall, this sword that was used to fight against the Upper Canada rebels. And J.S. Woodsworth's son, Charles, who was the editor of the Ottawa Citizen for a time, and then became a Canadian diplomat under the Liberals, went to Vietnam and during the Vietnam War, and was complicit in helping the Americans to carry out covert military operations. He was advising them on how to do so, and secret documents that have been released show that Charles Woodsworth, J.S. Woodsworth's son, was involved in the Canadian government complicity in helping the Americans to wage the Vietnam War against, revolutionary rebels there, the Viet Cong.
All in the family.
All in the family.
It
just gets passed. So the family is very powerful, and this pops up again and again and again in the magazine of, family ties and family traditions, and that this is often how these narratives get passed down, is from one generation to the next. It's not just passed down through newspapers or through preaching in the pulpits. Okay. These are powerful tools of propaganda for spreading narratives, for sure. But the family is also a very powerful institution within culture for passing narratives down from one generation to the next.
Richard, I want to just to, because this is a, we're based here in Winnipeg, and in fact, the University of Winnipeg, which includes Wesley Hall. I wanted to know if you might be willing to, and of course it's being recorded about 2 days before the start of the anniversary of the famous Winnipeg General Strike. I wanted to see if you could just maybe bring in some important anecdotes with regard to the social gospel as it was practiced here in Winnipeg, and how it may have affected the way the general strike played out.
Okay, so are your listeners familiar with the basics of what happened during the strike, or should we talk about that, or you're more interested in the social gospel, connection to the strike?
Yeah, principally. I mean, maybe just like a really brief rundown of the dynamics leading up to it, but I wanted to get into the what was happening in terms of like who was resisting behind the scenes and
Okay, people probably already know there was a huge strike. There was the leaders of it were arrested in late night raids, and it was against the law to rally in support of the leaders who were rounded up. But 30,000 supporters came out, and the Mounties got an order to fire into the crowd, and they killed a couple of people, and they charged in on horseback, and they injured dozens of people. Protesters were beaten with bats and wagon spokes, and they were wielded by these special police. And about 100 Reds were arrested, and then the city was occupied with military trucks mounted with machine guns, and the strike was called off, and there were a lot of radical labor activists that were fired and blacklisted, and the media blamed it all on, radical revolutionary foreigners, and then they did raids all across the country, and hundreds of radicals were rounded up and arrested, and a lot of these people were sent to a concentration camp in Kapuskasing, which is in northern Ontario. So it was a concentration camp that was still open from World War One, even though World War One was over. Some of the camps were kept in operation, and thousands of radicals were kept in these supposedly World War One concentration camps. So the camps didn't close until 1920. Anyway, this was part of a strategy to scare. Not only to control and kick radicals out of the country and put them behind, in cages in these concentration camps, but it was a way of scaring off anybody else from becoming active. Can you imagine if the government was rounding up activists now and throwing them into concentration camps? People would be scared to become in any way involved with radicals. You could be arrested for having a radical newspaper or wearing a button or anything like that. You know, so it would just kind of very. It's a very draconian way of controlling a society and a population just by scaring them. Now, you would when you think about stuff like that, you think about how it's. You know, it's the police and these scary elites in government that are doing it. But the progressive, so-called progressives, and they were the progressives of the day, were also had their role to play in this. So Wesley College, I guess you call it Wesley Hall now, it's part of the University of Winnipeg, but at the time it was a Methodist university. It was a college, a Methodist college, and it was the central, most powerful educational institution in Canada for promoting the social gospel. And J.S. Woodsworth went to that college, and he graduated with flying colors. He was the student president when he graduated. And the leader of, or the long-time founding president of the college was Joseph Sparling, another Methodist minister, and he wrote the introduction to the book that I mentioned earlier that J.S. Woodsworth wrote called Strangers Within Our Gates. And oddly enough, he included Aboriginal people as strangers within our gates. This was a book about immigrants who'd come to Canada, and he had a chapter on Aboriginals, which is wrong in so many ways. Sparling, who was the president of the Wesley College from 1888 until his death in 1912, said in his introduction to Strangers Within Our Gates, "There is a danger, and it is national. Either we must educate and elevate the incoming multitudes, or they will drag us and our children down to their level." And he also said, "We must see to it that the civilization and ideals of Southeastern Europe are not transplanted to and perpetuated on our virgin soil." So he, like Wordsworth, and like Wordsworth's father, James, the missionary leader of Western and Northern Canada, were very fearful about Eastern Europeans, and they were arguing that the church needed to play a much more important role in opposing these scary radicals and atheists that were amongst the newcomers that were coming to Canada. And they had a very fear-mongering kind of a narrative of doom and gloom about, how Canadians needed to really pay attention to this immigrant problem. And they were spreading using statistics to show how immigrants that are coming are more prone to crime and violence and that sort of thing, without any consideration for any... they blamed it all on kind of a eugenic... They had a kind of a eugenicist view of things. You know, everything was genetically determined. You know, their racism was a very powerful thing, and often people, when you talk about these things, about J.S. Wordsworth and how he was a racist and a xenophobe, and Sparling the same, and the other social gospelers, I've encountered this many times, and you also read about it, but I've heard people say this to me, they say, well, you know, you can't really judge people of the past based on our knowledge that we have today. It's called presentism, this idea that, you know, we in the present we're sort of privileged with this new knowledge that in the past they didn't have. And so we can't really blame them or hold them responsible or think in any way that they're guilty of any kind of wrongdoing for having gone along with genocide or for having gone along with and not opposed concentration camps or forced labor camps or discrimination against people based on their race or their politics or their economics. You can't criticize those people in the past because, you know, that's just the way people thought back then. That's just,
they're people of their time, and that sort of like lets them off the hook. Yeah. That kind of brings me to the last point, because we got to wrap this up pretty quick. But this idea of we've got a kind of a truth and reconciliation process happening right now. And I'm wondering if you have any thoughts about what that might mean in this context.
Yeah. Well, we really do need to come to grips with this history of ours in the progressive left movement, the NDP, which arose from the CCF, which arose from the social gospel, which had as its leaders people like J.S. Wordsworth, who were racist, xenophobic, imperialists, and classists. We have to come to grips with that history of ours, and if we can't, then how can we ever, come to grips with much more recent problems within the NDP, like supporting the NATO war against Libya, or supporting the rise of fascism in the Ukraine, or supporting the state of Israel, right or wrong, no matter what it does, we have to be supporting the Israeli government policies towards Palestinians and Israeli apartheid. So if we can't deal with those problems of the past, like reconciling and dealing with the truth of the fact about J.S. Woodsworth and the social gospel and the roots of this movement that we belong to in Canada, if we can't deal with that, its role in residential schools, its role in other problems through history, like Christianizing and Canadianizing and the sort of white supremacist roots of our progressive movement, how can we ever deal with these other much more recent and current problems of complicity with state power that's still going on within the NDP? We have to realize that even back then, there were radicals that didn't agree with the CCF, that didn't agree with the social gospel. There were opponents of that. You know, they were rounded up and put in concentration camps. They were rounded up and put into residential schools. Aboriginal people knew that they weren't inferior. You know, blacks knew that they weren't inferior. Jews knew that they weren't inferior to Christians. And it goes on and on and on. It's not that everybody believed it at the time. That's BS. There were people at the time who knew that it was wrong to practice genocide. Just like there are now people, radicals today, who know that what the mainstream progressive peace, human rights, development groups are doing in their complicity with imperialism, and this happens, like you mentioned, with responsibility to protect, and there's going along with the UN's arms trade treaty, which only deals with the illicit trade in weapons, and there's going along with NATO wars here and there, because we buy into the narratives that we're doing these wars, fighting these wars, because we have to protect innocent lives and their humanitarian operations, that sort of thing. There are radicals now who know full well that these narratives are false. There's a war of narratives that's going on between radicals and mainstream activists. And this, I think, is a really important part of our struggle, is not to just oppose these people that we see as the Harpers of the world, the right, or the Trudeaus of the world, you know, the power elites or the corporate elites. Our job isn't just to oppose them. Our job is to raise awareness of the people in our own movements who are being co-opted into believing the narratives which function to support imperial programs that are going on in the world. So we have to, and in some ways it's a more difficult struggle.
Okay, Richard, I'm afraid I have to leave it there.
Okay.
But I want to thank you very much for sharing this with us. Richard Saunders, organizer with the Coalition Opposed to the Arms Trade and the latest issue of Press for Conversion, which is on the topic we've been discussing today, Captive Canada.
For more on today's topic, the Coalition Opposed to the Arms Trade, and how you can obtain a copy of Press for Conversion magazine, please visit the website coat.ncf.ca. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are now also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.